finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old and will stretch out your hands, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the believers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, "If I want him to remain alive, I will return. What is that to you?" This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Before we get too serious today, I need to let you know there's another thing happening, and it's kind of been playing out on social media, which can be a really tricky kind of business, and I hate it when things get ugly, but sometimes they do. And we have a chili cook-off coming up this coming Sunday, September or October 21st, and some of us have sort of been pitted against each other, including myself and Pastor Wayne, and generally we get along pretty well, But I kind of feel bad for him, and I kind of need your help, because I've been cooking my whole life, and he sort of has come up against me and put in a bad position, really, to have to try to compete with me and my cooking ability, and he doesn't know how to open a box of macaroni and cheese. And don't tell him I said so. So it's going to be ugly, so I need your help. I need you to try to be nice to him when he loses next week, and you might want to be there so that in the midst of all of that smack talk and what's going on social media, which you can go look at if you haven't seen, we also are going to support an important ministry, a partner of ours, our Honduras mission with Ashley and Justin Guest. So that might be the real reason behind all of that, but that'll be next Sunday at 5:30 at the Greenwood campus. And I want to thank you for being here. You know, I think there's a risk in doing community together where we kind of know each other at a surface level. We kind of come in together and, you know, say the same things to each other and, you know, kind of how are you? I'm fine. You know, and I feel sometimes as even as pastor, you know, like the interactions that we have in general can be so shallow in our community that most of our interactions in our daily lives are based on sort of impersonal transactions, the people that we meet in stores or the people that we know at work. And yet, in the story of Jesus that we've been telling and come to sort of the culmination of today in this series that is the heart of the story of God, it's not like that. In fact, Jesus has this ability to kind of get right down to the heart of things with people and go far below the surface, and that when the early church began to rehearse the story of Jesus that we rehearse even today, it got real. It told a story of suffering and death and loss as its foundational story, the death of Jesus on the cross. And then as it told the story of its leaders, it was a story of kind of getting real. It was a story of failure. The story of Peter is a story of denial, of thinking he got it with Jesus and not getting it at all, or wanting to love him, Jesus, well, but not really being able to in the key moment. And it's what's remarkable about that, as you take a step back from it, is that the church told that story. It would be sort of human tendency, and it is our tendency to kind of push those stories to the side and tell the good stories, tell the ones where we look good, or, you know, in general, our image management keeps us from, you know, kind of digging in sometimes to the very thing that we need to dig in on. It's a danger of doing church in that kind of community where we just skim across the surface and grace doesn't permeate below that top layer. When we talk about getting a second chance, as we hear in the story of Peter today, it is not that surface thing. It is Jesus coming to Peter on the lakeshore after Peter has denied Jesus, as he's failed him, as he's gone back to fishing so that he's sort of doesn't know what to do with his life after the death of his friend, and the air has not been cleared. Jesus meets him on the lakeshore. And as they sit down for breakfast, he asks them three times, just like Peter had denied Jesus three times. Jesus asked Peter three times, "Do you love me?" Right there in front of God and everybody, it got real. And that's because that's what needs to happen. That's what we all need. We need Jesus' ability to bring grace, power, restoration, redemption into the hard parts of our own stories. It's been said that grace always flows to the lowest point. What I think that means is that in the very areas where we need redemption the most, help the most, in the places of our suffering, in the places of our loss, in the places of our failure, God's there. And we all have some mixture of that going on, some mixture of what we have done to contribute to that mix and what others have done, and sometimes it's hard and maybe even not necessary to separate out because the end result's the same. And if we're honest, the thing that keeps us from maybe telling those stories or knowing those stories or dealing with our own stuff is another word called shame, where we might think we're the only one, or we think that those failures define us, that our losses mean that we're losers, that our identity is wrapped up in this thing that makes us unworthy or unlovable. And we cut ourselves off from the very thing that God wants to do. We don't talk about, we don't share about, we don't get real about the very things where we need grace to come in the most. Does that make sense? And I don't think any of us wants to do that. When we go to a growth group, we want to kind of get past, you know, the prayer request where you're praying for Aunt Louise's, you know, ingrown toenail. You want to kind of talk about real stuff. And in, you know, helping each other raise our families, we want to kind of go past the idea that, those people have it all together and we're the ones that don't, and I don't know how to talk about that. We need to create safe places for grace to enter. We need to find ways to tell our stories and find ourselves in other people's stories and to get real. So today we want to do that. I felt like I have preached a few times on Peter and this story, and I felt like very clearly that we needed to do something different today. We needed to share some stories of people who have experienced suffering and loss and failure and pain and shame and life not going like they expected it to and finding that God was there. So that's what we're going to do. That was the sermon. That was the shortest sermon you've ever heard me or ever will hear me preach. So I hope you enjoyed that. And then at the end of some sharing today, we're going to experience communion as our commitment to rehearsing the story of failure that became our story of redemption, the story of execution that became our salvation, as we rehearse how the cross, which was the lowest of the low of the low, is the very place where grace flowed to and entered into our own lives. So that's what's coming. In between now, I'm going to invite three folks forward. I'm going to Shelley Lowe, Harold Busey, and Jana Goodnight. And I appreciate them being willing to share as we kind of put out there that this is what we wanted to do today. I just kind of let this be a volunteer kind of thing. Is this the mic that I want to use? Yep. Do we... do we have people that are willing to share their stories is kind of the heart of this, and some folks said yes. So let's welcome them forward and appreciate their willingness to share. The story of Peter is an intense story, right? And as is often the case in the kinds of stories that we're going to tell today, these are intense things and real struggles, and so it's not easy to talk about, and we've had lots of prep to try to get ready for what it should be like a moment where we're sitting in the living room just talking to one another with a whole bunch of them watching us. So feel comfortable. Thanks so much for sharing. We're just going to kind of go from one to the other and find ourselves in this story. So Shelley, kind of get us started. Why don't you tell us a little bit about you and your family and your story?
So my husband Bill and I go to this service as many Sundays as we can. We have our almost 7-year-old son, Davis, and he's actually with Miss Jenny right now.
Jenny Tagliabashi, Pastor
yes,
Lewis's wife.
She's an angel here on earth, and she stays with him every Sunday so that we have that opportunity. So that's something that we're pretty grateful for.
Absolutely.
But Davis's story begins a long time before he was even born. When Bill and I were first dating and engaged and then married, we knew we wanted at least one kid, maybe two. They were going to play sports. They were going to be very smart. Hopefully wear a tutu every once in a while and complete
right.
our family.
Everything perfect.
Everything was all in my head, mm-hmm. planned out. And didn't go that way, as things often do not. But we started the process of adoption because that was the route we felt we needed to go. We couldn't have kids biologically, so, you know, it wasn't even a period of mourning with that. We just knew that that's how it was going to be. So we started pursuing that and figuring out how to pay for that and how to prepare emotionally for that, if you can. And one of the gifts that we received was from the Adoption Fund here at Broadway. So a little plug for that. Davis is approximately 12% owned by Broadway.
I confess, because we are also, our daughters are adopted, and we are also recipients of the generosity of the church, but I never thought of it that way, 12%. Right, and what 12% is that, right?
It just depends on the day, really. So we started that process, and we were very quickly and surprisingly matched with a birth mother. We got a call on a Friday in April, and this birth mother in Franklin had delivered a very healthy baby boy the day before. And, you know, we were going to get to meet him in a couple of days. So we did that on a Sunday. We met him, and we took him home that afternoon. It was the fastest, craziest process, and I did everything you're not supposed to do in an adoption situation. Called everybody mm-hmm. I knew, had everybody meet us at our home and meet this little guy. He was amazing. So we lived with him and cared for him for 5 days when everything just sort of fell apart. And this very young mother decided she wanted him back, and she had figured out a way that she could take care of him where she had not felt that she could do that before. So we had to give him back that night, and it was right before Easter.
Wow. Yeah.
I could not go to church that Sunday because where yeah. do you see really cute babies dressed up to the nines? I just
right.
I couldn't do it, and Bill couldn't do it, and we just sort of lived in that grief for a long period of time. But I kept God out of it because I was so mad and so hurt. And I thought, this is so pointless. I don't understand. But I don't want to equate that with God. I don't want to make him part of that story, even though he was there the whole time.
Right.
And I just thought, we are rock stars. We are living through this, and we are going to move forward.
You've kind of been through the hard thing. Now
yeah,
you're going on
this is
the
hardest
next
thing we'll
yeah.
have to encounter, surely. We're just getting it out of the way so that we can move on to the next thing. And the next thing is going to be even better. Well, then we get matched with Davis. And, you know, from there.
You felt like it was right from the beginning.
Yeah. So on our adoption website, there were what we had listed as second chance adoptions. And there was a section for higher risk adoptions for whatever reason. our particular situation, the birth mother needed living expenses, but she had had plenty of other children before. And so we just felt connected to that. And I said, you know, that's our baby. I don't know why. You know, it's not a rebound thing, but that is our baby. I know we cannot afford this, but we're going to figure it out. And we had a lot of sources of money coming in at the time to be able to do that. And so we started that process. We talked to the birth mother. And then fast forward to October 2011, Davis comes 5 weeks early. We were not really prepared for that. We had bought all the things, you know, all the things that you think you need from Target and Bed Bath & Beyond and wherever. So as far as the stuff, we were ready, but we hadn't packed. So we made those preparations, and we drove to Tampa early that morning to meet this little guy, not really knowing what was ahead. He was born with a few different heart issues, but again, nothing real serious. We had no idea of the severity until several months later. And so we stay in the NICU there with him for about 3 weeks, and then we get cleared to come back home with him because the adoption process is different from state to state. So we actually had to live there for several weeks. Bonding, trying to bond with him, even though I was so guarded, just did not want that same thing to happen, as, you know, that had happened before. So we get him home. Everything's great for a few months. We knew he had a lung condition, so we couldn't put him in daycare for the first year. And we had family members to step up and take care of him while we continued to work. And all of a sudden one day, it was the middle of cold and flu season, and he got really sick. We just didn't know why, but he ended up going to Vanderbilt at the suggestion of his doctor. And again, he had already been to Vanderbilt for a follow-up when we first got home. So he had had all of these tests run on his heart. Everything looked pretty good, but we knew we would have to follow up every few months just to make sure he grew correctly. And, you know, after about a week of being in the hospital, they finally found it. You know, it wasn't even there the week prior, but they could see where his left ventricle was at 5% functioning. Yeah. He would need a heart transplant, and it was going to be a long time spent in the hospital. Yeah. So at that point, I thought, okay, I'm ready. We're going to need a lot of Jesus for this. We're going to need a lot of prayer to get us through this time. So after several months of being in the hospital, I think we were there about 5 months, almost 6 months total. And on the day of his transplant, we get the call again. And, of course, it's, you know, also surreal. We have all these people praying for us. And we have Pastor Rick at the time was preaching here, and he came down for the transplant while we were in the waiting room, and he prayed with us. And just to see all of these people in the waiting room, you know, some of them joined in that circle, and that was pretty awesome just to know that all these people are praying for your child who's going back. And just that process of handing him back over to these nurses and doctors and knowing that he's in the best hands possible, but you have no control over any of it. You know, there's just...
It's hard to put into words, isn't it?
You can't. You can't put that feeling into words, and I don't even know how we got through that. It was definitely the grace of God.
Right. So then he has a heart transplant, and you think, okay.
Yeah, surely.
A heart transplant, surely.
Surely that's
that. Then you
the
put
worst.
That aside, and then you move. That's the worst, and then
yeah,
you move
it's like,
on.
Yeah, it's like, just get us through this. Surely that's the worst thing that we're going to have to deal with. But then we get him home, and over the next few years, he has a lot of other issues that come along, one of them being that he's on the autism spectrum and he's nonverbal. So if you have kids, just imagine what that's like to not know what they're thinking or what they're feeling or even what they're capable of most days. It's kind of heartbreaking. And so Bill and I kind of live in that space of being totally okay with where he is and being so proud of him and so grateful and starting that day with just this heart of gratitude, but then wanting so much more and wanting to know that he's going to live this really great life and inspire people. And, you know, you just want everything,
right.
And it's a mix every day. But, you know, even with the challenges that he has, and nothing comes easy, and we have to get labs done every 3 months, and we have 10 specialists that we follow up with, and It's just this constant struggle to keep him healthy, but keep him involved. You know, even with all of that, I think God gives us this grace to accept and to hopefully extend to each other and our family and the people that we meet. Every night, you know, here's this nonverbal kid. He might say a few random words at school, and for everybody under the sun except for mom and dad, he doesn't really say those words for us. But every night, rock him to sleep, because I'm going to do that until I can't carry him to bed any longer. And I say, Davis, do you love mama? Every night, almost without fail, he whispers, yeah. And it's just this most peaceful moment, and I get to live that every night, and I get to start fresh the next day. You know, I don't know how long he'll be with us. I don't know anything, but we get to live in those moments, and we get to be surrounded by so many people who are encouraging to us, whether it's his teachers at school or the many therapists that he's worked with, or, you know, just our circle of people who are our friends.
Right. Right.
God has sent us all these people at different times when they're needed the most, and I really don't think that that's any coincidence.
Right. So let's thank Shelley for sharing that. What a what a wonderful description of the tensions that we all live in. I think we sometimes get the impression that Jesus resolves those tensions, and we find ourselves, most of us, I think all of us, living in those. And that's where grace is. So thank you for that. All right, Harold Busey, I appreciate you being willing to share. You have a very different kind of story, and that's what we wanted to, you know, to find people among us. You've been coming here for a while and often come to our 11 o'clock service, but we drug you in here in front of God and everybody, and I appreciate you being willing to share too. So why don't you just tell us a little of your story, Harold?
I started coming here, I think, at Easter, and I felt at home. I go to Pathway on Sundays too, and that's been such a blessing, mm-hmm. the people there and the experiences there. I'm from Calaway County, Murray, Kentucky.
Okay.
Grew up in church, but I was always seeking something, and I ended up getting in retail and moving to California, moving to Arkansas, moving to Washington, but always looking for the next promotion or the next car, or it was always based on something external.
Right.
And somewhere around the age of 39 or 40, I discovered crystal meth, and pretty quickly, my world started coming,
yeah.
started coming unraveled. And when I discovered IV drug use, it unraveled at a rapid pace. I became homeless for 3 years off and on. I lost jobs. When I was working, I would get a paycheck on Friday, and Monday I would be overdrawn. I was in and out of institutions, psych wards, hospitals,
yeah.
treatment centers. I ended up at a place called Haymarket in Chicago, which is where destitute people go. I had gone from the best treatment centers that insurance could pay for to the only one that was left.
Wow.
And I really all I had at that time was the pants that I wore in and the shirt that I wore in, the shoes that I had. I had managed to lose everything, and it was not a good situation. Very painful. I felt alone and lost and
right.
hopeless and helpless, but I still kept looking for an external fix
right.
for an internal problem, which doesn't work.
Right.
And I reached a point where I decided that I was tired of fighting, and I took all of my Klonopin, and at some point I came to, and I was in a hospital with a neck brace on, and there were 2 weeks that I don't recall what happened, but they told me that I was very, very blessed that I had any recollection that I could actually form sentences, because they didn't think that I would come back from that. Because I was just babbling pretty much for
yeah.
those 2 weeks.
Wow.
And that was God working in my life. I know that.
Right.
And I was fortunate enough to be able to come back and spend some time with my mother. And that's kind of when things begin to get better.
Yeah, so your mother is really an important part of your story.
My mother was my rock. You know, she was so kind and loving and non-judgmental. I know that she and my family praying for me are the reason, one of the main reasons that I'm here today,
yeah.
that I came through that, that they didn't give up on me. They prayed for me, you know, filing missing persons reports and coming and looking for me.
Wow.
And all kinds of things that I put them through, but the love was always there. And her prayers were always there, you know, never judging, just accepting and loving and praying.
And you speak, I mean, this is a story we don't always get to hear. It's not a story that everybody survives, right? So
we had a roommate that that had OD'd and died at our front door. We tried to get in one morning and we couldn't,
mm-hmm.
Because he'd made it to the front door, but that's as far as he got.
Wow.
I was in a friend's house when someone else had a massive heart attack and fell down dead. I had several friends that OD'd and died. It was a very common occurrence.
We know this is an epidemic. It's not something we're always talking about in the church, and
yes.
we need to. It is something that affects people in families and
yes.
our communities. And
yes.
Absolutely,
it's horrible. Mm-hmm. But when you're in the middle of it, those things don't seem abnormal.
Yeah,
you know,
that was your normal.
That was what normal was. Yeah. Only when you come through it and get out of it do you realize truly how blessed you were to get through that.
Yeah.
And I would know that God was watching over me at my worst times.
Wow. So you also talked about looking for an external fix to an internal thing. So have you found in God the acceptance and the love that...
Yes. Everything, like Dorothy said, everything I was always looking for was already in there. That I was okay just the way I was,
yeah.
that I didn't have to...
That you were loved.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. That not only did my family love me, God loved me.
Yeah.
And he loved me just the way I was.
Yeah.
And that all I had to do was listen to that and then try to get back.
As the most powerful voice above all the other voices.
Oh, yes, yeah. yes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I know that's not easy, but we really appreciate it. Let's thank... It's a powerful, powerful story. And then Jana is a member of another church and a friend of ours from the community. And so when I put this on Facebook, Jana was the first one to respond. And we happen to have kind of gone along in life with two kiddos the same age. So, you know, PTO at Cumberland Trace and all that, and swim team and all that. And you know, you have another kind of story to share. So appreciate
you. I do. And I, to be honest, the first time I shared my story was about 2 hours ago
yeah,
in the first service.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I cried throughout the whole thing. I'm hoping I will do better this time, the second time around. I said this morning I can talk about Mason, my son, who passed away at the age of 10 for hours on end, but I have never shared my story in relation to Mason's passing before. I grew up in New Mexico, and I was in a family that believed in God. My parents believed in God. We went to church not every Sunday. We went for sure every Easter, and we went more than just Easter, but we were definitely there on Easter. My husband, Jeff, was at church every Sunday. He was the kid that the sleepover, his parents picked him up from the sleepover, and you went to church. And so when we met, I started attending church with him. I can honestly say that I my whole life I have believed in God, and I have believed in heaven, and I lost my father when I was 18 years old. I've lost all of my grandparents, and I had peace with that. I knew they were in heaven. I was okay. I was more focused on myself during those losses and my missing them. I've always had a hard time really, truly praying. I never felt like I was praying like you're supposed to pray. And at our church, they take communion every Sunday as well. And my father-in-law is a huge source of comfort to me. Always has been since I met him. He is a very calm person. And I sit in church, and he takes the bread, and he prays. And I'm supposed to be praying. I'm watching him thinking, what are you praying about? And
yeah.
I just could not get, I knew how to thank God, and I thanked him for my children, and I thanked him for my husband, and many things, but I didn't know how to ask him through prayer to help me.
I think you saying that, I don't want to stop you too much, but I think so many people relate to that. Like, you know, everybody has the perfect family. Everybody has the perfect life. Everybody has this perfect, you know, even a church. You have the spiritual life. Those people, they must have it figured out. It must feel different for them than it does for me. They must know what they're doing when they're praying. And it's not true.
Yeah, no, right? I realize now. I'd say the majority of my adult life, that's how I felt. Like, yeah. Everybody's got this figured out so much better than me. And I can't, I mean, I've raised my kids right, and I think I'm a good person, but I don't know. I just could not get a connection. And then I find myself on April 6th of 2017, after a short visit to Florida, Mason became sick with what appeared to be the flu. He went to the park. He didn't feel great. We flew home. And he had a little bit of a fever, takes Tylenol. He wanted to go to bed. I planned on taking him to the doctor in the morning. And when we woke up, Mason had passed in his sleep. He was 10 years old. And obviously my world was just completely flipped upside down. There's not one emotion or one thing I can say that I felt. I was in shock for a while. But here I was, not feeling this connection that I so desperately needed. But I also now was not just okay with the idea of you just pass and you go to heaven. I needed more detail than that. I wanted to know what happened here. I had this 10-year-old, and even though I wasn't with him 24 hours a day, I knew where he was 24 hours a day. And here in a split second, I didn't. And I called Adam, and I said, I need to talk to you. And he came, and I said, I need you to tell me. You truly, and he couldn't tell me that. And I think it was hard for you that he couldn't help me in that moment tell me what exactly had. So I, during these days after his passing, before the funeral, I once again turned to my father-in-law, because everybody in the house and everybody's upset, and he is calm. Like, more than just being stoic for the rest of the family, he is calm. And there's a peace about him. And I would find myself constantly seeking him out and just watching him. And I know how much he loved Mason. He loved him so much. So I know he's hurting, but he's calm. And he's got peace about himself. And at some point we were in the kitchen, and I said, you're the calmest person here. And he said, I know he's okay. I know that. And I realized at that point that what he had is what I needed to have. I needed that much faith. I needed to have that kind of faith that no matter how hard this hurt or how much I would miss him for the rest of my life, I needed that much faith and that much peace to know that he was okay. Mm-hmm. It was better than me. It was okay. And I have gone back to that moment standing in my kitchen talking to him so many times. I did not give up the search for after we leave this earth.
Right. You read the books.
Can be hard and not comforting at times. And I learned how to pray in this process, very much so. And I pray for a lot of things, and I still thank God for a lot of things. But I, my biggest prayer has been, because it encompasses everything for me, my daughter, my husband, my friends, is peace. I've found myself kind of on, you know, in contact with so many people, and have met so many people through this. And there have been situations where I felt, I read in one of my books that somebody describing grief, and they said that they felt their loneliest in a room surrounded by people who love them. And that is very true, yeah, sadly enough.
Yeah.
It is very true. I no longer feel that way, but I remember feeling that would be my loneliest point.
And that peace, because I remember you saying this like the day after, like, I still have a daughter. You know, it's like, we're going to have to find a way to live.
Yes.
when it would be easy to stop. And so peace is like this comprehensive thing, like it applies to everything.
It applies to everything.
By definition, right, that's what it is, right? Yeah, to be
there. And I pray for that.
And that's the thing you pray for.
That my biggest, my whole prayer is focused around peace. Whether it be peace for her or peace for what's going on, peace and understanding what others are, you know, you can sit back after you've lost a child and watch other parents in situations, and maybe I pray for peace and my understanding of that. I would just pray for peace all the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. Let's thank Dana for her story. And all of you for your courage and your ability to express things that are hard, but they are so important for all of us who have different things and different kinds of stories, but all are united in God's ability to meet us in the midst of that and to kind of go past the surface stuff or the trite spiritual answers that, you know, are, or the books that are written that kind of help us feel better but not deal with the real thing. Our hope is that grace gets in there and meets us in the real, and you help us see how that happens. So let's thank them again, and we're going to move on to communion. But we really appreciate you all. We realize that there's a lot more that we could say. But that's what community's for, to be able to share life and to go deeper in our small groups with people that we walk with in our families, united in the same story of redemption. And so we remember that on the very night Jesus was betrayed, in his lowest of the low moments, when grace needed to flow to the lowest point, at a table with his friends, he took bread and he said, "This is bread, but this is also my body, which is going to be broken for you." What a remarkable thing to say. Imagine the faith it would take to say that, and the assurance that God is going to do something redemptive. And then when the supper was over, he took the cup and he gave thanks to God for it. And he said, this is something I'm grateful for, an offering to God in my blood that will be for the forgiveness of many. A cup of redemption, a new promise. And so the cross becomes the symbol of God's ability to meet us in the lowest of the low. And then to come with the power of resurrection that doesn't necessarily resolve the tensions that we feel in this life, but gives us something that we didn't expect and a power to walk through it that we didn't know was possible. We want to claim that promise today. We want to live those kinds of stories. And so we're going to invite you to come. We're going to do it a little bit differently today. We have 5 stations, just like usual. So if you're usually here, you're probably going to go to the same spot. But we're going to release you by row. You'll be kind of told when it's time to go. And we're going to come around these tables. We wanted this to be a kind of kitchen table moment. This is more than just sort of standing in a line and processing through, which is fine. Today we're going to stand around the table like Jesus was at table with his disciples. And in the community of those who have this promise, hear the story of redemption yet again as it's offered to us in the bread and the cup. And so in preparation for that, let's pray together. Gracious and holy God, you meet us in our place of deepest need. We're so grateful for the stories that we have heard today and for those so willing to share them. We're so grateful for your great love for us, that you were willing to come and humble yourself and make yourself nothing to experience something far beyond, far more painful, a deeper level of suffering and shame than anyone could have anticipated, so that you might reveal to us that nothing, not even death itself, can separate us from you. So would you meet us in this bread and in this cup, in the story of Jesus, that the story of redemption and salvation in him might be our own stories. And we pray this in his name.